Hello and welcome to Inside Briefing, the podcast from the Institute for Government. I'm Bronwyn Maddox. Well, the mood in Westminster is, this word is a favourite of all lobby journalists, febrile. Things are moving fast. We're recording this at midday on Thursday, and right now we can say that Sue Gray has not yet published her report into Downing Street's parties. Not enough Conservative MPs have sent in letters calling for a vote of no confidence in the Prime Minister, and Boris Johnson is still Prime Minister. Who knows where we'll be next week or even at the end of this podcast? But to make sense of where we are right now, where things might go, and to think about some of the bigger questions as well, I've got two brilliant IFG colleagues with me in the virtual studio. Senior Fellow Kath Haddon. Hi, Kath.
Hi, Bronwyn.
And Programme Director Alex Thomas. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Bronwyn.
And I'm really delighted to be joined as well by someone who understands the workings of the Conservative Party and the job of Prime Minister better than most, and that's LBC presenter, podcaster, pundit and author Ian Dale. Hi, Ian.
Hello. Hi.
Thanks for finding time in this busy week to join us.
Well, it couldn't be busier, really, could it? I mean, you just never know what's going to happen from one minute to the next.
It couldn't really. Let's start with what we're calling party time and take stock of what's going on right now. We've had, just this week, a recently elected Conservative MP defecting to Labour. Far more experienced one, David Davis, told Boris Johnson to resign, but we're still waiting for Sue Gray's report. So, Kath, take us through the mechanics, what's going on and what comes next.
Well, we are, as you say, the famous phrase now, waiting for Sue Gray. It looks like after the sort of heat of Tuesday and Wednesday that the Conservative Party has decided to wait and see what her report says before taking any action. And beyond that, we don't really know. You hear rumours and so forth. The Prime Minister has said she will report next week, but there were also reports that she was still investigating and interviewing Dominic Cummings this week. So hopefully a rapid turnaround. She's got to write up her findings. There's two parts the report. There's the report as a whole, which has all the evidence and might have lots more details about specific individuals. And then there's the findings. We still don't know exactly what will get published, but it will be her findings, which will include her conclusions. So if that is at the beginning of next week, then it is the Prime Minister will come and speak in Parliament and answer questions. But really, everything then will be happening probably on Twitter and on the airwaves as we wait and see how the Conservative Party react to it.
Thanks for that. And Ian, just before we go into this week's detail, a decade ago you edited a book called Prime Minister Boris and Other Things That Never Happened. Mm-hmm. That did happen. Has he surprised you in how he's handled his premiership? Are you surprised we're at this point?
In many ways, no, because when he became Prime Minister, I think I wrote somewhere that I thought he'd either be one of the most brilliant Prime Ministers we've ever had or one of the worst that we've ever had. And I think, I mean, he does have some achievements to his name, but the way that he has diminished the office, you'd have to say that if he did leave the office in the next few months, he would have to go down as one of the, well, he'd certainly be in the bottom quartile of prime ministers. You may remember, Bronwyn, when I came on the podcast about a year ago now to talk about my book, The Prime Ministers. Well, I wrote the chapter on Boris, and I wrote that in April last year. No, was it April last year? Yeah, it was sometime.
The year before.
Yeah, the year before. Yeah. And I've now got to write the update for the paperback, and I've got to finish it by February the 14th. Can you imagine the challenge that that's giving me at the moment?
Every sympathy on this, every sympathy. Well, you're a very seasoned watcher of Prime Minister's questions. What did you make of this week's exchange?
Well, often when you have a big build-up for PMQs, it never quite lives up to expectation. And it didn't yesterday until David Davis got up. I mean, you had the drama of Christian Wakeford crossing the floor, though even that I didn't think was particularly dramatic. And, I mean, I don't know if you want to go into him now or if we're going to talk about him later, but I interviewed him on my radio show last week, and he was clearly very unhappy then. And I asked him if he'd put in a letter. And he hummed and hawed and wouldn't really answer. And in the end, he said he hadn't had time to write it. And we finished the interview. And as he walked out of the studio, he turned around and said, "I have put it in." I said, "Well, why didn't you tell me that in the interview?" In some ways, he's quite a tortured soul. He's not particularly well known. He hasn't done a lot of media. And I was watching him this morning doing a little speech to the Bury South constituency Labour Party. I mean, awkward doesn't cover it. He was stuttering. He forgot Keir Starmer's name at one point or hesitated before he said it. I think this is going to be one of those defections that doesn't really work out very well for either party. And it wouldn't at all surprise me by the time of the next election if he just decided he'd had enough and wanted to get out completely.
That's really interesting. And so, in the great history of defections, this one may not matter.
All defections matter to one extent or another. But I think what happened at the end of PMQs when David Davis got up, that reminded me of the morning in June 2008 when he announced that he was resigning his seat and standing in a by-election. No one saw it coming. I spoke to, and David's a good friend of mine, he used to be his chief of staff. I spoke to him on was it Monday or Tuesday morning? I can't remember now. And we obviously talked about the situation, and I asked him if he had sent a letter in. He said no, he hadn't, and he actually seemed reasonably supportive of Boris Johnson. And then that happened. You think, well, wow, where did that come from? And I think,
and by that you mean the big ringing quote, yes. "Your name rated Neville Chamberlain, you have sat here sat too long here for any good you've been doing. In the name of God, go."
Yeah. I think, and I spoke to him shortly after he did it, I think what drove him to do it was the number of younger colleagues who had talked to him that morning and said, look, you are a big beast, not a big dog, a big beast, and we're looking to you to give a bit of a lead on this. Now, I don't know how many there were that said that, but he certainly said there were quite a few younger MPs that were urging him to do so. If you look at the write-ups this morning, a lot of journalists are saying, well, he's not popular among young MPs and that they've been slagging him off. And I think he knew when he did that, he would become persona non grata with quite a lot of people on the Conservative benches. You heard, as soon as he sat down, I heard someone shout out, shut up. And there was quite a volcanic reaction. I think one or two people, from what I read, abused him in the tea room afterwards. But it was quite a thing to do. Now, time will tell what effect it had. Some people are saying, well, it solidified support for Boris. I'm not quite sure I see the logic of that. But it was certainly something that people will remember for a long time, whether you agree with him or not.
Kath, let's talk about these letters. How does the process work?
Well, I mean, there's been a lot of talk about it, but, the main thing to say is it happens in a great veil of secrecy because nobody knows the exact number of letters that are put through until we reach the magic 15% of Conservative MPs, so 54 letters. And at that point, Graham Brady, the head of the backbench committee who receives them all, lets the Prime Minister know and they work out a timetable and then it's announced. And that might be by Graham Brady puts it out, as a statement, or it might be that the Prime Minister comes and sort of tells people what he's going to do. So we might see podiums outside number 10, you never know. So at that point, they then go to a leadership contest. When Theresa May did this in 2008, sorry, not a leadership contest, this is the important part, they go to a vote of confidence in Boris Johnson, that alone. And so when Theresa May faced this in 2018, she held it the next day. So we could expect it all to happen very rapidly next week if that occurs. Then it's whether or not the Prime Minister gets 50% of MPs, over 180 of them or more, to support him. And then kind of there's politics around how that looks, because it's not just a question of winning through. It's also a question of whether or not you've got the backing of people. So there may be other things peripheral to that that also matter, like resignations from government and so forth. But all of this obviously depends on the Grey report and how people respond to it.
And what about the accusation today from William Ragg, senior Conservative MP, head of the PACAC Committee on Constitutional Affairs, that Number 10 is trying to blackmail, his word, MPs who aren't supporting the Prime Minister?
Yeah, and this is a very interesting one, because to some extent what Ragg's talking about is usual practice from the whips, that they try and put pressure on him, to vote the way that they want to do so. And there's various carrots and sticks that they can use for that. And carrots are obviously future jobs in government. But also there's how much attention that their constituency might get out of things that the government are doing. But this is all a very grey area, because obviously we want public spending to go where the evidence and the policies say that it should go. But there is always some kind of murky dealings when it comes to the arts of the WHIP's office. But RAG has come out very strongly saying that he considers this potential blackmailing of MPs. And that's a very serious accusation that Number 10 are saying, we'll look into this. Let us know if there are any specific allegations of this. So
he's talking about things like threats to release embarrassing things to the papers, stuff that has been in the WHIP's armory for decades, for longer than that. But he's bringing a very modern twist to it, isn't he? Saying, look, this is something that perhaps the police could be interested in.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's kind of drawing a line between the idea of an MP as the sole representative of his constituency, who is, you know, powerful in their own right in Parliament, versus being, as it were, an MP within a party where you are beholden to the power structures of that party. So there's a kind of tension there. But I think it also goes to what Ian was just talking about, that there is this splitting happening within the Conservative Party about the way to handle this, not even just on the question of Boris Johnson's leadership and Partygate, but also the way in which they've managed this whole situation. And, you know, RAG, like David Davis, may have considered that he needed to do this in order to protect some of his colleagues. So again, it's sort of tensions within the Conservative Party that are bubbling to the surface.
I just want to pick up on that point. And Alex, perhaps you can come in on this. The point that Kath was just talking about this presentation of William Ragg of himself as an MP acting on conscience, you know, obviously part of his party, but not going to be told what to do in every circumstance. That is a shift, isn't it?
William Ragg is becoming quite an interesting figure in some of this. So he chairs PACAC, as it's called, the Public Administration and Constitution Committee in the House of Commons. It's fair to say there was a bit of surprise when he was elected, I think early in 2020. He hasn't been a minister. He was elected in 2015, so has some experience of Parliament, but is still quite young and quite sort of early in his parliamentary journey. There's a striking sort of courage to calling out this sort of stuff. So I think, as Kath was implying there, it should be no surprise to anyone who follows this sort of thing that the whips will use all sorts of tactics to try and secure votes and secure loyalty for the prime minister. There are two aspects to this, I think, that are unusual. The one is the calling out in such a public way in a select committee and clearly in a pre-brief to the media potentially. And then the second is how it does interact with government policy. I mean, some of the specific allegations that Ragg seemed to be making were about, you know, quote unquote, levelling up money going to individual constituencies and that might be withdrawn if MPs aren't loyal. Now, there are rules around that. The ministerial code that we hear so much about says that you shouldn't sort of mix political your public money with party political interests. And there's a set of rules in government that are less well known about managing public money that give permanent secretaries responsibility for calling out where money might be being used improperly. But the fact that Ragg is doing this is quite an unusual thing.
What did you make of, you've worked at the heart of government, what did you make of the alleged Operation Save Big Dog? A phrase Downing Street says it does not recognise as applying to the Prime Minister, and the parallel Operation Red Meat, which it does to chuck policies at Tory MPs.
Yes, well, I mean, as others have said, I think one of the main mistakes was briefing it out, either, you know, intentionally or not. The moment you brief something like that out, it reduces its effectiveness. It reminded me of previous Prime Ministers, and most obviously in my experience, Theresa May after the 2017 election. You know, one of the powers of the office of Prime Minister is getting on with the job and keeping up the momentum hour by hour when you're in the midst of a crisis, and then extending it to day by day, then week by week, month by month. That's how Prime Ministers survive, is by in these sorts of situations, is by you know, keeping going and getting things done and reminding their backbenchers why they were elected. So I don't think it was a sort of unusual tactic. I think it probably was the right thing to do. There was a bit of perhaps a bit too much haste in briefing some of these things out, particularly when we saw Rishi Sunak push back in cabinet, according to reports around BBC license fee decisions or some of the other policies around immigrants in the Channel. So the execution might not have been brilliant, but I also think it points to, you know, Boris Johnson's constituency now is not so much the public. He's lost that. It's Conservative backbenchers, which was why that Beth Rigby Sky interview was so damaging, I think, because it showed a man who didn't have much get up and go for his backbenchers and his cabinet who want to be led.
Ian,
the big dog has been saved so far? Is it working, these operations?
Well, the problem with calling it Operation Big Dog is it invites other names like Operation Dead Dog or Dog's Dinner and things like that. Well, he's still there. So from that point of view, it's working. I found it very interesting yesterday that there were many journalists and commentators thinking, oh, well, the Christian Wakeford defection and what David Davis did has strengthened Boris Johnson. I was thinking, are you mad?
There was a lot of that in the papers, wasn't there? Saying that Tory MPs suddenly sort of felt they had to pull together, they might be sullen about it, but they stopped.
Well, I don't see that. I think if you were going to send in a letter, I don't see either of those things as things that would prevent you from doing so. In fact, you could argue quite the reverse. I do think there is an argument for MPs waiting until Sue Gray reports and to decide whether they send in letters or not. Graham Brady used to work for me back in the mid-1990s. And anyone that thinks that he's briefing anything about how many letters he's got is deluding themselves. They don't know the man. He hasn't done it in the past, and he's certainly not going to start now. All any of us can do is make educated guesses based on our experience of watching Conservative backbenchers over the years. And about a week ago, I thought there probably were about 20. I think at that point, five or six had gone public. But Conservative MPs aren't known for their courage in terms of telling their constituents what they're doing in these things. So, and I suspect the figure is way in excess of 20 now, but it clearly isn't up to 54. I don't know. I suspect it isn't even close to 54 at the moment. But of course, some people will be thinking, okay, well, I put in my letter, I'm the 54th one. What happens then? And what happens then is that there is a confidence vote. Boris Johnson, I think, will contest it and he will win it. Now, the question then is, by how much does he win it? It would be slightly ironic if it was by 52 to 48%, wouldn't it? as all opinion polls see.
Which means it probably will happen. Yeah.
I did a poll the other day on whether I should wear ties on television, and it came out at 52-48 in favour.
In favour of the tie.
Will you abide by the will of the people, Ian? That's the question.
Operation Save the Tie.
I did when I was on Newsnight last night. So, but in a way, say that happened. Anything under, I think, a two-thirds majority for Boris Johnson would be considered as a bad result. If you get two-thirds of the party, I think you can reasonably carry on with a bit of confidence into the future. But if it's much under that, it would be death by a thousand cuts. Now, from the Labour Party point of view, that's what they would like. I mean, if you noticed yesterday, Keir Starmer didn't go in for the kill. Now, I don't know whether that was deliberate or not, but if I was a senior Labour strategist, I'd be quite happy for Boris Johnson to be kept on for the moment. If you have a bright, shiny new leader, remember what happened in 1990, John Major takes over, wins the next election against all expectations. History can repeat itself in politics. We're seeing so many things over the past 5 or 6 years where we think, yeah, we experienced that in the 70s or 80s. So I think Labour have got quite a dilemma there. They would quite like the kudos of getting his scalp, but on the other hand, it may be more advantageous for him to stay there a bit longer.
Hard decision for them. Let's just turn to Sue Gray, still hanging there. Talking about her last week. Kath, what can she do and what can't she do?
Well, so, I mean, this has been a slightly movable feast because her original terms of reference were very much setting out the parties, what happened, the context of them, and talking about, you know, whether or not they broke guidance, broke the law. She can't rule on the law, but she can sort of set out her view about, you know, how they pertain to the law and the government guidance at the time. But it's expanded into this question of what the Prime Minister knew. Because, you know, even before it came out about the 20th of May 2020 party that he has acknowledged attending, there were questions about, but did he know these were going on and why was he saying that he was sure he had been repeatedly assured that no guidance was breached? So the real question is how much she's going to talk about that. She isn't the official advisor who, you know, looks into matters of the ministerial code and the all-important question of whether or not he deliberately misled Parliament on any of this. but she might now have enough to say about what he did know that gives MPs the opportunity to make their own minds up about that. And we know she's been speaking to Dominic Cummings, who has claimed that he personally spoke to the Prime Minister on that. So she might not feel she's got enough evidence to rule one way or another, but even if she does a narrative that sort of sets out, well, you know, he said, she said, that Dominic Cummings said this and the Prime Minister has said that, but it's impossible for me to conclude one way or another, that still might create enough doubt in MPs' minds about what Boris Johnson has done. So I think it's going to be come down to what the Prime Minister knew as much as any more revelations that we have about exactly the nature of any gatherings and parties and how bad she thinks all of that was.
That sounds completely plausible. Alex, you wrote a great piece for us this week which set out the huge pressure and the expectation being placed on Sue Gray. Are people and ministers misunderstanding her role?
That's a good question. I'm not sure most of them are misunderstanding it. I think it's more because, you know, when they turn up on, Ian's excellent programme or the Today programme or whenever, they don't really have any other answer at the moment. So one of the reasons why we hear Sue Gray's name time and time again is there's not a lot else for ministers or the Prime Minister to say. And the intensity of the political focus on this means that everybody's talking about it all the time. I do think, I mean, what I put in the piece over the weekend was ministers and the sort of political system is putting more weight on Sue Gray's report than it can bear. The point I was making was that cabinet ministers, other ministers, backbench MPs in the Conservative Party have a sort of responsibility to reach their own judgments about whether they want Boris Johnson to be the leader of the party and the country, and not outsource that judgment to Sue Gray, which is not for a moment to say the report isn't important. I think, as Kath was just saying, there could be all sorts of aspects in there. You know, it's important to get to the bottom of civil service conduct, which I think is the right sphere for Sue Gray to look at. It's also important that if there are officials in Number 10 who have said to her explicitly, I told the Prime Minister this, or I had a conversation with the Prime Minister, it's quite difficult for her not to then record neutrally, dispassionately in her report, multiple accounts said X, Y, or Z, which could either make it easier for the Prime Minister or make it harder. So I see why people are waiting for the Gray report. I do think it's important, but it shouldn't be the basis really on which MPs reach their final judgment about who should be Prime Minister.
There is an amount of almost deciding what the goalpost should be and the shifting goalpost. So you see a lot of people talking about what the report might say, which some of which is and also a lot of briefing in the newspaper about what they think she might cover, some of which could be about also setting out what are the sort of key measures for them, whether they're sort of, you know, in support of Boris Johnson, whether it's coming from Number 10 themselves, or whether it's people who actually have already made their own minds up about what they think are going to be the sort of key tests for them. And, you know, that's ranged from Dominic Raab saying that deliberately misleading Parliament is a resignation matter. He's gone very strong on that. But obviously, that all hangs on the word deliberate. So it's very possible then to argue, well, there's nothing in the report that shows that. That was the high watermark, and it's all below that, so I can continue to support him. So a lot of it is also about how they're framing the possibility of what she says.
Yes, we're starting to see briefing coming out that Number 10 are worried about what's in the Gray report. Expect to see more of that. That's setting the expectation.
Having had quite a lot of signals last week, right, deliberately placed it, they were not worried.
And if they're worried, of course, that helps frame that when the report comes out and it's less bad than people are expecting, you know, that shapes the story.
The thing is, Alex, I think you worked with Sue Gray, didn't you, in the Cabinet Office? You probably know better than any of us. I had some dealings with her when I was in publishing, where I had to submit ex-minister's memoirs to her for vetting. And we had some hilarious exchanges because
hearing about some of them, Ian.
Do you? She knew that I knew that actually she couldn't force me to do anything, that there was no legal power for her to. So we had some very interesting discussions about, it was usually revolving around Buckingham Palace, the palace wouldn't be very pleased about this. We both knew that we were playing a game, in that I would concede a couple of things just to please her, and she wouldn't be too ratty about the things that I insisted on. But I found her...
What are you deducing from that for that report?
The one thing that I would deduce is that, I don't know if you remember this, Alex, but in David Law's book on the coalition years, he recounts an anecdote of a breakfast with Oliver Letwin, who was Cabinet Office Minister. And he was giggling to himself about Sue Gray being the most powerful woman in Britain. Well, how prescient was he in that comment in about 2012? I deduce that Sue Gray is the sort of person who is not going to be influenced by anyone. She will do what she thinks is right. She's not a typical, I mean, I don't know what a typical civil servant is nowadays, but whatever it is, I don't think she is a typical one. I think that she will give her honest view. That's what she's been deputed to do. Yeah. She's not there to bring the government down. She knows that. But on the other hand, she can't do what a lot of people would expect a typical Sir Humphrey to do and come out with a whitewash. This is not going to be a whitewash.
Well, we're going to have to leave Sue Gray there, I think, until the report actually appears. But I want to turn out at just a few of the bigger questions that all this has raised. And Alex, we were talking about Sue Gray, indeed, typical civil servants. I'd like to talk just a moment about the role of officials. A lot of predictions that there's going to be a clear out of some from Downing Street. How are they feeling at the moment?
Yes, I won't get drawn on what a typical civil servant is or isn't. You know, that's dangerous territory for me. It's tough for officials in Downing Street. I mean, worth remembering, you know, of the 450,000 civil servants, this touches very, very few of them. This is about a small circle in Number 10 and the Cabinet Office. But it's, you know, it's difficult for those individuals who are not used to being in the spotlight or perhaps being under scrutiny, even if their names aren't out there. You know, the context of the people who were either at this or other parties or not at other parties is, you know, it's not a comfortable position for an official. I think we already have heard quite a lot about the sort of culture of Number 10. I think it is worth noting that Number 10 in particular, the tone is really, really, really set by who is Prime Minister. So it's a cliche that the culture comes from the top. But I think in Number 10, that is particularly true. So there are questions for the Prime Minister there, regardless of what he knew or didn't know. That said, there are clear obligations on civil servants to act honestly, with objectivity, impartiality, and so on. It is important that where there are specific allegations against civil servants, those are investigated by Sue Gray and then referred to proper processes. So it won't be a comfortable time. I think there'll be just a lot of, you know, as we all are, kind of waiting to see what happens.
Yeah. Kath, ministers have been lining up to say the Prime Minister will be held accountable in Parliament. What does that actually mean?
Well, it's one of these terms that gets thrown around a lot, but then often frustrates sort of the public who want to see, you know, judgments called. But actually being held to account ultimately means going and accounting to Parliament for what has happened. And then it's up to Parliament or MPs or others to, as it were, take action. In practice, what it means is he will probably come and do a statement to the House followed by questions. Those are often only an hour. So it might be that the Speaker allows for more time, but that actually is a bit of a problem itself. There's a lot of issues that are going on here, as some of which is obviously focused about the Prime Minister and his future. But as Alex has been talking about, you know, there are some wider issues that need to be explored. I'm sure that various select committees, including William Ragg's PACAC committee, will want to look into them in future. So, yeah, the holding to account thing, I mean, it is really going to come down to Conservative MPs holding the Prime Minister as their leader to account. It's not really an opportunity that Parliament has. They're a bit thwarted as a whole in doing that, other than just questioning the Prime Minister and setting out their views.
Ian, there's been a lot of talk about whether we need a new standards regime and ways of, you know, if the Prime Minister's broken the ministerial code, doing something about it. What do you think?
Well, you can always update all the different standards regulations. I'm not sure we need to sort of throw everything out and start again from scratch. It's not broken beyond repair. I'm hesitant to say that there should be a whole-scale reform because it would mean that we are subjected to even more appearances by that ridiculously outdated figure, Sir Alistair Graham.
Kath, you've been writing a lot about this. What do you think?
I mean, you know, we've said that one of the main issues at the heart of all of this is it shouldn't have been Sue Gray. It shouldn't have been the Cabinet Secretary in the first place who was asked to do this investigation, because you know, it would have been quite clear from the get-go that this was going to expand into the questions about the Prime Minister, and that's very serious. The proper person to have done it would have been Lord Guy, but he can only initiate investigations if he's asked to by the Prime Minister. So we have been arguing since he, you know, since before he was put in place, that this role needs to be changed so that they can initiate their own inquiries, that they've got the proper powers to be able to launch investigations and support of staff to do them properly. And that means that, you know, it would have been him that we would have been talking about waiting for Lord Guyte rather than waiting for Sue Gray. So that's, I think, the main change that we need to see in the aftermath of this. But there's a lot else that the government need to respond to that was in our own reports last year, and the Committee on Standards in Public Life and select committees. And they do. I agree with Ian. Yes, of course, you don't need to throw out the entire thing. But I do think we need to look at how much we rely on marking of own homework in the way in which ministers in particular are sort of held to standards and ethics.
I would also note that the main previous period of reform and sort of improvement on the standards and ethics regime was in the mid-1990s, after or around the time of Cash for Questions and the problems that John Major was facing then with Lord Nolan and his reforms. So there is a sort of cycle in British politics of scandal and then response, which we may yet see, whether it's led by Boris Johnson or another, we may yet see happen over the coming years.
Yeah, well, now really quite a lot of calls for the government to adopt all the recommendations of the Committee on Standards in Public Life, including obviously from the committee. So, Ian, help us wrap all this up. If the big dog does survive, can he reset his premiership?
What will happen, I imagine, is that he will have a mass clear out in Downing Street, both of advisers and civil servants, and start again. I think if anyone thinks that's going to solve the whole problem, they're deluding themselves. Yes, there does need to be a clear out, particularly, I think, in the communications department at number 10, which is just hopeless. Who was it that advised Boris Johnson to do that interview with Beth Rigby standing up in a corner of a room in a hospital with a face mask on? I mean, you don't have to know much about communications to know that that was a very bad idea. And there are all sorts of incidents. Who thought it was a good idea to send Jacob Rees-Mogg out as the man to defend Boris Johnson on the airwaves when he comes into my studio and calls the leader of the Scottish Conservatives an insignificant figure? And then he goes on Newsnight 3 hours later and does exactly the same thing. Did no one think to speak to him in the meantime? So you shouldn't be saying that. That's not really very helpful. So I think the whole communications department almost does need to start from scratch. But it goes beyond that. I don't think that Dan Rosenfeld will survive this. I suspect Simon Case might not survive it. I think there'll be wholesale changes within number 10, basically to say, send a message to Tory backbenchers, see, we've listened. But it needs to go way beyond that. There will need to be some radical changes of approach in policy. We all know what's approaching in April in terms of energy price rises. We all know what's approaching in terms of the national insurance rise. Something will have to be done to ameliorate those. It could be that they decide to knock the green levies off energy prices temporarily for a year or something like that. There needs to be a reset, and that
Talking about a reset of policies, not just of how number 10 goes about.
I think it's got to be sort of ground zero, start again. Now, all of us who've studied politics for as long as we all have know that once a politician loses trust, the trust of the voters, it's incredibly difficult to get it back. And I'm not sure that Boris Johnson is capable of doing that, because there were so many people in 2019 who didn't vote Conservative for the first time. They voted for Boris Johnson personally. And it's many of those people who feel most let down. Now, I hear from them day after day on my radio show, and they don't seem to me to be the type of people who are going to be persuaded to go back to the fold in any way whatsoever. But of course, then Tory MPs have to judge, well, yeah, if that's the case, okay, we get rid of him. What then? Does anyone seriously think that Liz Truss is going to appeal to those voters? I don't think so.
No, but it would be a new start, and the scale of the change you're talking about might be easier with a new prime minister, some might think.
It depends on who that is. And yeah, it's not as if there is a ready-made replacement waiting. It may be that there would have to be a completely new face. I wrote a piece in The Telegraph profiling the 14 different runners and riders that I identified. Mm-hmm. And as I was doing it, I was thinking, do any of these really have what it takes? I mean, I think you have to look at outsiders rather than necessarily just the two favourites.
Well, with that tantalising thought, which I'm sure we're going to return to, we're going to have to leave this episode of Inside Briefing. So my huge thanks to Kath Haddon, Alex Thomas, and especially Ian Dale. Great that you could be with us. Thank you all for listening at home. If you like this podcast, do check out our sister podcast, IFG Live. You can find all our podcasts at iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Please do leave us a review too. And do check out our website, instituteforgovernment.org.uk, for all our latest comment and opinion, some useful explainers on, for example, how conservative leadership contests work. So it's been another extraordinary week in British politics. The coming week promises more of the same. Is it still really just January? See you next week.